thank you for listening to the Hops and Hooves, a humanity podcast. We're a couple of board-certified behavior analysts living in Oregon. I like beer. Sam likes horses. Put it all together, Hops and Hooves, a podcast where we can share our snarky perspectives on life, beer, animals, and applied behavior analysis.
We decided to cut our originally one conversation, which we should have known was absolutely not going to happen, into two parts so that it's not 4 long. So this is going to be part two of our discussion that we started with Jeff Newman. And Jeff is going to walk us through I believe a specific case at JRC. I do want to throw out like a sensitive content warning. I myself may have to get up and walk away at some point, just because there are traumatic things that happen there. I am a trauma survivor. If you are a trauma survivor, I think what Eric and I will do is try to go through and edit in a couple second space between the most traumatic parts so that you have a chance to sort of get up and leave or skip forward. But just know if you're not like paying a lot of attention and you kind of are like in and out, you may hear some things that are distressing.
Yes, this is, you know, I don't want to sugarcoat it. This is a horrific story. This is one of the most bone-chilling things I have read. And I am saying that as somebody that literally, so, you know, the main thing I am going to be doing here, the main data that I am referencing is a copy of an investigation report done about the death of Linda Cornelison. At JRC, at the time it was known as BRI, Behavior Research Institute, because Linda actually died in 1990. I talked in the last episode about, what I do for a job, and that a big part of my job is investigating allegations of abuse, investigating every death of somebody with an intellectual and developmental disability. I am the primary investigator for that of a very large portion of my state, about 150 miles wide and about 100 miles tall. If something like that happens in my area, I am the one roped into writing the exact same investigation report, the exact same thing that I am going to be referencing here. That was done through the Massachusetts developmental disabilities system. They're doing these because it's a Medicaid requirement to do this. That's why we're doing it. And so that's my data source here. And this is horrifying. And the other thing I want to say is because this is horrifying, a lot of my coping mechanism to talk about horrifying things is often sarcasm and black humor.
Dark humor.
And I am talking about, I want to acknowledge that I am talking about a human being here who did not deserve this, who sounds like, Linda stays on my mind through the work I do a lot of the time. She sounds like somebody I would like to know and somebody that didn't deserve any of this. And so while my natural tendency is sarcasm and humor as just as a way to process this, I don't want anybody to interpret that as any disrespect to Linda Cornelison, who simply deserved better. You know, when we're presented with a horror show, and I believe this, I believe what happened here is an absolute horror show, it tends to come up as so this is like the report I'm reading from. These investigative reports are intended to document and investigate what actually happened, who has responsibility. They tend to make criminal referrals if criminal laws have been broken, but that isn't typically the focus of it. The focus is on why did this happen and how can we prevent it from happening in the future? And so, you know, one thing that I want to say at the lead of this is, One of the things that shocks me as an investigator doing these investigations is there are a ton of places where JRC actively did not cooperate in the investigation into how somebody died on their premises. And that is really shocking to me, and something in a long time of doing this type of investigation, I have never seen. I have investigated a lot of deaths. I've investigated 5 deaths this year. And including deaths that the coroner ruled a homicide. And in all of those deaths, I have never encountered an organization that has given me any flack. Every organization I have encountered has been totally on board with opening our doors. We're going to show you everything. We're not hiding anything, because the last thing in the world we want is somebody else to die. So it is absolutely shocking of all the different places in this report where you see pretty stark evidence of a cover-up. To frame what we're talking about, I do want to ask, and this is one of these black humor type things. Both of you are credentialed in the field of behavior analysis. You seem to know your stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. We like to think so.
Yeah, sure.
So in your understanding of the literature and the research, when somebody is having a life-threatening health emergency, what does the research say about the correct dosage of torture for that person?
Wait, I know the answer to this. Hold on. 0.
Has that actually been researched, though? Have they actually said if somebody is in the process of dying, that it's not actually effective to their health outcomes to torture them?
I wouldn't put it past us if we had,
Honestly, there's a certain place that puts out their own research on a person, they may very well have some research related to that.
Well, that's kind of what the lead of this story is. Linda died in 1990. She died December 19th of 1990. Linda died as a whatever you want to call somebody who is at JRC and not being paid to be there.
Prisoner.
Used prisoner last episode. Can say a lot of things. However you want to say, Linda was there. And Linda had what is characterized, and throughout this report, it uses the R word because we're talking about 1990. And in every case of that, I will change that to intellectual disability. Linda is reported to have a severe intellectual disability, and not a whole lot of verbal communication skills. Says she uses sign, says she has a few words, but is definitely somebody that would struggle to report kind of what's going on, right? Linda was, I believe, 19 years old at the time of her death. The actual investigative report I'm reading from it was finalized and turned in 1995. Whoa. January 3rd, 1995 is when the report was completed. So, died in December 1990. January 1995. So a little over 4 years, right? Going December to January is when the actual report of what happened got turned in. The investigation only started in 1993. She died in 1990. And it is an absolute requirement. If you're providing this kind of services and somebody dies, you have a paramount responsibility to the immediate call you make after you're calling to line up like emergency services, getting this person to the hospital, The next place you're calling is you are calling and reporting this. Different states have different people you're supposed to report it to. It's pretty common, as it appears to be in Massachusetts, that you're reporting this to somebody in the developmental disability system. A lot of states you're also going to be reporting to adult protection. And, you know, a lot of states you also have a responsibility to report it to police. Somebody just died, or somebody is about to die. Somebody is life-threatening. This is all triggers all of that. There is a 3-year gap here, and the specific circumstances of that 3-year gap are unclear. There is some data sources on this that say JRC actually did make a call when Linda died, but it does not appear. It doesn't seem like they made the call to the right place. Like, they called up, instead of the actual hotline that you would call or where you should call, they called up like the local office of the DD system and said, hey, somebody died. And nothing seemed to happen. And so the investigators actually found out about Linda's death. The people that would actually identify this 3 years later, when a JRC employee it may have been a former employee on another investigation into something else, was apparently referenced this as, and, you know, by context was probably referencing this because of how shook up they were about it. Mm-hmm. And so it came up of, you know, and I'm making inferences here, but as somebody that's done these interviews, it probably popped out as, you know, this was bad, but it wasn't even anywhere near what happened to Linda. And
right. The
investigator seems to have, you know, gone, who is Linda and what happened? And that's kind of what broke open this investigation in 1993. Okay. Linda was admitted into the Behavior Research Institute, now JRC, in 1984. So this would have been, she was 19 in 1990. 13, right?
13.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is when she was brought in. So she spent 6 years at the school. Another thing that's really important to note and understand here is, at this time, JRC did not use electric shock. They had not developed the GED yet. Mm. That actually happened shortly after this and may be related to it, but they were not using the GED at this time. So I want everybody listening to this to think about, you know, there's a possibility that the GED gets banned. If you noticed just yesterday, Court of Appeals, the FDA is appealing the reversal of the ban. They're continuing to fight, and it's entirely possible that that's successful and we're back in a situation where the GED is actually banned. So we actually have data points to know what JRC looks like in the absence of a GED, in the absence of electric shock, because it's their past. Just banning the GED is not going to in and of itself prevent them from using aversives. They may not be able to go back to all this stuff, but that's the mentality, you know.
But it does create a vacuum, and it just tells them what they can't do. It doesn't tell them what they can start getting a little more creative. Correct.
And we have no evidence that the mindset has changed.
Right.
These aren't people apologetic about using aversives. They defend it as incredibly effective, the best thing. They're like, you know, that does not seem to have changed. So, and Linda faced a ton of aversives herself. This is what's documented in the report of different things that she would receive. She would receive an aversive, painful administration of an aversive is how it is put here. So the 8 major categories for that is aggressive behavior, health dangerous behavior, destroy, I believe it means by destroy, probably destruction of property. Health dangerous behaviors, like they've doubled this one up, it's both one and four, but in four, it specifically notes that the health dangerous behavior they're talking about is inappropriate urination or defecation. So if you have an accident, we're deeming that a health dangerous behavior and, you know, a reason for us to hurt you.
Right.
Non-compliance is number five. Ooh. So you say no to us, this is what we're going to do. In education socially, I assume they mean like doing inappropriate things when you're supposed to be learning.
It's probably like being off task and not doing your work.
Not following instructions. Yeah. 3 seconds.
Right. And Linda lived, like, you know, this is a residential school. Linda lives here. So this is 24 hours a day. This isn't just during school. Major disruptive. I would assume that means like yelling and screaming or other stuff that affects other people. So that we take out on Linda. Inappropriate verbal. So inappropriate verbal is defined as non-speech noises, silly laughing, and nagging. If Linda did these things, Linda is going to get hurt. And I am not, like, when I say hurt, I really mean hurt, because this is the next thing that this report documents of how Linda would get hurt if she did these things. And this is definitely one of the, like, we're definitely hitting trigger warning. Be aware that this is a point to take that break. Linda would receive spatula spanks. So we're not just hitting with a hand, we're hitting with the device. We've ratcheted up hitting with the device specifically. And if you've been hit with a spatula, you know, you can leave marks from a spatula. Finger pinches or forced to inhale ammonia. And for inappropriate verbal, it's a little bit different. If she displayed inappropriate verbal behaviors, then consequences would include rotating taste aversives, which they document further on as being stuff like hot sauce, being forced to swallow hot sauce, vapor spray, and ammonia. So Linda doesn't get physically hit for simply laughing. Other elements of her treatment program were fines, loss of privileges, and here we go, earning her calories.
Earning food.
To get enough food to live, she had to earn it. And this was common at JRC up until about 2013 is when they finally ended the what they called the food reinforcement program, which literally meant Matthew Israel did not hide it. It's straight up in the FAQ of for people deemed severe enough, you would literally not be allowed to eat enough calories to sustain yourself unless you met their standards. And for some other people, if you did, if it wasn't quite that bad, your food would still get taken away from you during the day, but you would be allowed at the end of the day to have makeup calories. And makeup calories were purposefully gross food that was served cold, as unappetizing as you can imagine, and sprinkled with liver powder.
So we're teaching unhealthy eating habits, binging, purging,
Well, and part of this is this food program is you would be forced to dispose of your food yourself. They gave you your meal portioned out. And if you did something somebody didn't like, you would be required to take a portion, get up, and go throw it away in the trash.
The trauma, like just.
Yes. And so according, you know, JRC always defended this as it's not starvation, at least in this case. You know, these other people are on the starvation program, but if people were allowing to make up food, we're not starving them because they can still eat the food at the end of the day. Right. If you can stomach eating food sprinkled with liver powder.
Ew.
cold.
If you even want to call that food.
Cold food. It specifically intended to be as gross as possible. If you can stomach eating that, then you're not going to starve. But fair assumption that a lot of people could not stomach eating food like that. And so no matter if it was available or not, would still be starving under this program.
Especially if you potentially have like sensory differences in your system, you know, texture, smell, sights, probably makes it even harder.
So I do want to be clear, you know, credit where credit is due. Part of this plan is also documented as Linda received casual rewards such as verbal praise, a pat on the back, and or pennies.
Oh my God, pennies. So nice.
Yes.
Wow. Hey, Eric, I'm going to touch it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So it's not all horrible. You know, she got pennies and casual praise.
And high fives, basically. Got it.
So we mentioned Linda died on December 19th of 1990. This is what the investigation found happened in the days leading up to Linda's death. So you know, and they kind of looked really closely at time period starting December 11th and ending at her death in December 19th. So between what this documents is between December 11th and 14th, so days before Linda's death, did not show any signs of symptoms or illness. On December 12th, a week before her death, JRC made the decision to allow Linda to go from 1,500 calories a day. She was getting as a 100-something-pound 19-year-old, 1,500 calories. And she was allowed to bring that up to 3,000 calories as a result of orders from two different physicians. And these orders had actually come through 2 and 4 weeks prior, but they only managed to actually start feeding Linda more food just a few days before her ultimate death. And, you know, you can read between the lines there and say, for physicians to say this person needs to start eating 3,000 calories, probably concerned about the weight. And it, still, we're splitting the difference and saying most of a month went by before they actually started changing this around. So investigators are noting that there's some evidence starting on December 11th that Linda was not eating all or part of her meals, which generally does not track with Linda's typical behavior. Linda seems to have really liked food. So it would have stood out if she was not completing all of the food she had access to, especially, you know, when you're doing stuff like you have to eat the food because you never know when it's going to come again. If you do something wrong, people are going to take it away from you. So while it's there, you better. So on December 15th, so 4 days before her death, and December 16th, Linda refused dinner. And there's some reporting, again, that she may not have eaten some food before that. This may have been going on before that, but it's not clear because JRC's documentation didn't really capture it. Had paperwork that the documentation would say how many calories Linda was offered, but wasn't really tracking how much she was actually eating. So different people have different recollections of how much, but it seems pretty reliable that as of December 15th, 4 days before her death, Linda was not eating, even though they had ramped up this amount of calories. And they also seem to have made a mistake here where, because they are dictating how much calories Linda, very closely, how much calories Linda has access to. One of the things they have here is a floor. When they doubled her calorie intake, they made a mistake and didn't bring the floor up of the least amount that she should be eating. So the floor was 300 calories, and it should have also moved up to an absolute minimum of 600 calories when the doctor said you need to eat 3,000, and that actually didn't seem to have happened. they were using an old form that still had 300 calories on it. All right, so so now we're kind of getting in the thick of it, starting on December 16th, 3 days before her death. Her behavior started becoming unusual, and some quotes from staff state, December 16th, she refused snacks on the bus and was getting out of her seat. This is the bus transporting her from the group home with JRC where she lived to like a day program at JRC. She was refusing to eat or eating very little. She was acting fidgety, making unusual sounds. During the night of the 16th, so that night, staff observed these signs, and staff did not notify any of the medical staff that is there at JRC or a case manager. So I want to stop here and point out, when I talk about JRC stonewalling this investigation, one of the ways they did it is they actually have, you know, by this report, they have pathologists representing JRC. They have primary care physicians available. They have doctors that it's unclear if they are actually on staff or just the doctor that everybody sees. And
contracted, man.
The pathologist that's associated with JRC refused to participate in this investigation. And the primary care physician for JRC refused to participate in this investigation. I've never experienced something like that in a death investigation.
Right.
I've never ever experienced somebody associated with an organization saying at a level like that, saying go pound sand.
Right.
Because generally people don't want other people to die. So
or at least want to help here. Figure out
So morning of December 17th, 2 days before death, staff says that this is the first time that they advised the staff nurse that Linda was feeling ill. They reported that Linda is not eating, that she always eats, her behavior is unusual, and she is acting fidgety. So this is the first time that people recall alerting nursing staff. What the investigation found is none of the nursing staff recall being notified of this, and there isn't documentation that they were formally notified. But staff is saying this is the point where we started telling people 2 days before the death. There's evidence that the altered eating pattern started a few days before this, but December 17th is when we're on it. Staff also quoting December 17th. She seemed fairly sick. She looked white. She looked pale and tired. During the night, she kept getting out of bed the night of December 17th and walking to the door and going back to bed. Linda never had out of bed behavior and was very lost, looking all around her like she didn't know where she was. She also kept going into the bathroom, and she had multiple attempts to vomit. Her eyes were glassy. Linda never slept that night. Linda had been awake all night, sticking fingers in her throat. All document, like, this is what a bunch of staff reported of what they observed of Linda on the 17th. There is no evidence that the nursing staff became involved or checked Linda prior to the morning of the 18th, outside of normal routine body checks, whatever that is. And so another discrepancy is, this is probably another trigger warning part. The autopsy for Linda and several staff documented a whole bunch of bruises on Linda's arms. These bruises are very likely related to the aversives that were being deployed on Linda. The nurses never noted these bruises. Getting the hospital staff, emergency room staff noted and documented it and were concerned about it. But nursing staff did not document bruising. This is another thing that stands out of working in this field. It is a straight up requirement. Yeah. Somebody has injuries on them. Mm-hmm. You write reports on those injuries. It is documented. Right. You do not. Mm-hmm. Even if you know how it was caused, right, you write down how it was caused. Right. So there is no question. Really stands out to me. So
I was just thinking internally, we have very intense procedures for like a tiny human has a mark because they fell down because they're a tiny human. And it still yes. goes on like all the forms and all the everythings because
All right. So this is another major, major, content warning part here to talk about what also happened on December 17th. You just heard all those quotes of people noting how Linda looked really sick. Mm-hmm. This same night that people are talking about looking pale, really unusual behavior, a content warning, I'm quoting from the report, Linda received an unusually high number of aversives during the overnight of December 17th, when she was documented by staff really feeling sick. Mm-hmm. Overnight, Linda was spanked 8 times, had muscle squeezes. The number on the documentation is illegible of how many muscle squeezes she got. That's probably why she had bruising on her arms. Mm-hmm. Was administered ammonia inhalants and had taste aversives, which they note here as vinegar mix, jalapeno pepper, or hot sauce as the taste aversives. Administered several times.
A combination.
How many is that for the night? Yeah. What's that number?
I'm going to get to that. It's
okay.
They have a graph where they document it, or a chart where they document it, but we're not done with that. So on the morning of the 18th, and I believe Linda died early in the morning on the 19th. So this is effectively the last day of Linda's life. Continued to display unusual behavior, both at the residence and during transportation on the bus. In the morning, she had inappropriate urine and was very non-compliant. She had inappropriate motion and she was touching others. Quote, I didn't give her self-care because I knew she was sick, even though she didn't have a fever. I'm not entirely clear what self-care means here. It seems like by how that sentence is structured, self-care may mean something horrifying. Because it sounds like the context of that, it sounds like we laid off Alinda because we knew she was sick. Like it sounds like self-care is a euphemism for something not good there.
Yeah, we didn't take care of hygiene needs or whatever, right, like could possibly.
Yeah, good point. That very well may be what they're talking about. She was pulling at the clothes at her stomach. She was touching her stomach like she had menstrual cramps. Mm. Quote, she was trying to tell us something. I honestly thought she had pain in her stomach. Quote, she was bringing her feet up to her stomach, her knees to her chest, holding her stomach. Quote, she looked pale, tired, and lethargic in the morning. Quote, she was limp, hanging on me on the bus. She got out of her seat and put her head on my shoulder. Quote, she was holding her stomach. Quote, she was one-on-one on the bus because she was sick. She does not require one-to-one on the bus. Quote, on Tuesday morning, getting off the bus, she wouldn't move. She was looking around. Two of us tried to stand her up. She was sitting in a puddle. I told them to get someone to carry her in. And in fact, somebody did carry Linda into school on the morning of December 18th off of the bus. She could not walk on December 18th that morning. Linda did not go to the hospital that morning. So at least two staff that morning advised nursing staff that Linda was ill, that she was not acting herself, that she was holding her stomach as if in pain. There isn't good documentary evidence, because again, this is years later, to specifically say what exactly nurses were told. But this is what people are telling them they told nurses. So the nurse reports that she performed an evaluation of Linda shortly after she was notified at 9 o'clock a.m. She made observations of Linda until 3 o'clock p.m. So Linda was allowed to rest on a pullout couch for the day in the classroom, given frequent fluids, placed on low demands.
How about no aversives demand?
Were, yeah, but not taken to the hospital.
No
aversives were utilized between 9 a.m. and 3 o'clock p.m.
Oh, well, how nice of them.
Oh, we'll break.
Yes. If you notice, there's a hard stop to that gap in aversives. Mm-hmm. The nurse says she checked Linda's temperature and abdomen, which she stated was normal in both cases. Her whole body, watched her face and looked into her ears. She also stated that she tried to look into Linda's throat, but she couldn't. She stated that Linda was not having her period and was not constipated, as she had had a bowel movement. Not noted by the nurse was she had a bowel movement at an unusual time and was normal pretty reliably having bowel movements in the middle of the night. However, there is no written documentation of a physical exam of Linda's abdomen at any time of the day on December 18th. The only document that is any record of Linda's physical condition is a routine nursing body check sheet, which is filled out each day. This one notes, Linda arrived at school pale and lethargic. Had been awake all night, sticking fingers in throat. Temperature 98.4, unable to see beyond wax and ears, allowed to rest given frequent fluids. So for you two that are serving as my audience, if this was going on with somebody that, you know, worked in your center, how concerned would you be if somebody needed to be carried off the bus?
Oh, they would already be like at the hospital. There's no, absolutely no way.
Oh yeah, the caregivers would have notified for sure.
That's that's, I mean, to be honest, even just like being lethargic and holding their stomach and looking like they're in pain.
Do you think the notification to caregivers would be, I'm calling 911, meet this person at the hospital?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
I
could see at least, like, at the absolute minimum, from my perspective, would be like, hey, I am really scared.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's going on. I'm feeling like I need a call for an ambulance.
Right. How do you feel? What do you think is best in this? It might be that an ambulance isn't best. Maybe we need to take them, or mom needs to take whoever. But like they need immediate medical care, and I need to know how you want us to go about getting them that care.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, possibly within the range of possibility is maybe parents say, oh my gosh, this has happened before. This is the thing. I'd be scared. She laid on a couch all day that she seems to have gotten carried into.
And I'm going to assume that no one like laid with her or like read her stories or like told her that they loved her.
Provided comfort.
No, probably not.
Not known. I mean, it does say the nurse was regularly checking in.
Okay.
By the way, there is some other indications in this investigative report that seem to indicate that the nurse thought she was faking. And that may be part of why medical services were not arranged. So they say that nursing staff, there's no evidence that the nurse staff or the doctor asked about, you know, Linda's presenting as not being able to walk and very sick. They didn't ask about what's happened in the past 24 to 72 hours, like when did this start? No evidence of that. Nurse stated in her interview that she interpreted Linda sitting in a puddle and having to be carried into JRC from the December 18th morning bus ride as a behavioral problem rather than a sign of illness. Behavioral problem. So like I said, nurse didn't think it was real. There's, you know, other documentation that there's an emergency room note made after Linda was taken to the hospital, which stated that the nurse did not feel Linda was acutely ill, but was acting sick. There's further documentation of like this communication breakdown of why Linda did not end up going to the hospital during that day. And so what actually happened is Linda went back to the group home that night. And the group home was not informed that Linda seemed to be really sick, and was not informed that Linda appeared to be sick enough where they weren't giving Linda aversives during the day. That was not passed along to the group home. Again, that is JRC. Yes. So as horrific as this has been to this point, this is where we escalate how horrific this is. So the first thing that happens is the group home gets permission to increase the number of aversive allowed to be given to Linda in a day to 95.
Jesus. You
can do 95 of this thing. So you know, nobody's broken any rules at this point.
No, they're following
procedure. They're still doing this by the book. This was, they followed the procedure of, hey, how much more can we hurt this person?
Is it 95 in is that like a 24-hour span?
Then it says 95 for the day.
So probably. So that's a lot. One every, like, what, 15 minutes-ish?
yeah, and it wasn't evenly spaced out.
Right.
So again, content warning gets bad between 3:52 p.m., which, you know, basically got home, and sometime prior to 8 o'clock p.m. on December 18th, numerous aversives were administrated to Linda. As punishment procedures were administered between 3:52 and 8 o'clock as follows. Deep breath. At 3:52 p.m., she was administered an ammonia inhalant. Between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m., she was spanked with a spatula 8 times, had 8 finger pinches, was administered ammonia inhalants again. Each hour after that, the punishing applications were continued, so that by 7 p.m., Linda had received 8 spatula spankings, 27 finger pinches, 14 muscle squeezes, and several ammonia and taste aversive applications. Baby. At 6:45 p.m., staff had noted that Linda was not herself.
Oh, wonder fucking why.
Yet within the next hour, 7 to 8 p.m., she was spanked with a spatula 5 more times, was finger pinched 2 times, was administered an ammonia inhalant at 7:40 p.m., and may have other aversive applications. Nature and number are illegible. So they know they did more stuff, but the number is smudged, so they can't tell. Thus, between 3:52 and 8 o'clock p.m., Linda had been physically punished at least 56 times. 13 spatula spankings, 24 finger pinches, 14 muscle squeezes. She also received at least 5 inhalations of ammonia and taste aversives. And, you know, the investigator notes that this is likely a further indication that she was and continued to be ill.
You're doing all of this, so, and there's no response. There's no change. Right?
Well, I mean, a point, like, one of the reasons I think this is really important to go through is when you remove safeguards to say this is not allowed, because an unfortunate reality is sometimes when you're working in a position of support, you may have competing motivations or motivations that do not line up with the person you're supporting. An unfortunate reality is if you're a worker, sometimes you have motivations where you're motivated to do what will be easiest for you. And right. when you create exceptions that put stuff like this on the table, for staff that are willing to do it, this becomes easy because it is a lot of easy and effective ways to stop the person from acting out.
Right.
If this is not allowed, if you know that a likely response to you hitting somebody with a spatula is you're going to spend the night in jail and your career is going to be gone, that is a strong incentive not to do that. And so if that's all off the table, the easiest thing for you to do is probably to work with the person to understand why they are hurting so much and try to problem solve and figure out what the actual underlying problem is.
Right.
But when you create these exceptions, this is exactly the culture you set up. Because the easiest thing to do is just hurt the person until they comply with you. That's literally built into what they're saying should happen here.
Yeah, we know that humans are given the chance.
Right.
Yes. So we get to the chart I mentioned. You asked Sam on December 17th, how many aversives? 28. Versus the 15th was 9, the 16th was 3. 28 on the 17th. And at least 61 on the 18th.
Okay.
At least 61.
After notable change in her behavior, demeanor, status, and that there's possibly a very clear medical reason for it.
It is noted all over the place that Linda is sick. Linda's really sick. You know, apparently the only person that really sounds like they didn't believe Linda was sick was the nurse. Everybody else, even the people, you know, doing these aversives, all seem to be noting she's really sick. Mm-hmm. And we're hurting her. And remember, she had that huge gap in the day where aversives were off the table. So of those 61 aversives she got on the last day of her life, 56 of them were done in that 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The 4 o'clock-ish to 8 o'clock-ish. And the aversive stopped because finally around 8 o'clock is when I believe that somebody actually decided that, here it is. At 8 o'clock, staff found Linda on the floor, won't get up, and something is wrong with her. Staff noted that when they went upstairs, Linda's eyes were glassy and she was very pale. She had been to the bathroom to have her pajamas put on. She was sitting and laying on the bathroom floor, which was out of character. She was, quote, semi-responsive. Several people stated Linda had a bluish color to her skin. There is pictures from the emergency room admittance that show her skin being blue. So that's the point that they called and, you know, started saying Linda has to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. However, JRC directed that they should wait for a medication certified administrator who was to be arriving at the house to dispense medication to evaluate Linda. So this person arrived about a half hour later at 8:30. And after this person checked Linda, they decided that we should actually call the ambulance. And that happened at 8:39. She is semi-responsive and she waited for a half hour to have somebody call her an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
This medication administrative person notes that she found Linda's extremities were blue/purple. She had labored breathing. Her eyes were glassy, felt a pulse rate of 110, could not detect a radial pulse in either arm or a pedal pulse.
Wow.
Went to the carotid artery and felt a pulse. Her rate was 110.
Okay. So not good. Not good at all.
Kind of sounds like Linda's been actively dying for close to an hour at this point.
Sounds like it.
So the ambulance gets there at 8:45. They got to the hospital at 8:55. So upon arrival, she had an acute abdominum is how it lists this here, and was in shock. Blood pressure was zero upon arrival. She needed full resuscitation, 5 liters of fluid. Extremities were cyanotic. So like purple, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aggressive treatment executed in the emergency room. Lab test, an electrocardiogram, and an x-ray of the abdomen was performed, along with a chest x-ray. She was being taken to the operating room because her blood pressure was progressively becoming lower and lower. Despite the rapid infusion of IV fluids that she was getting, x-ray of the abdomen demonstrated a large amount of free air in the abdominal cavity. So they get her in for emergency surgery. And, you know, this is like, you know, this everything else from this point is just full on code out emergency room. And she died on the operating table. Died of perforated ulcer would be the layman's term for it. Untreated perforated ulcer. And the post-op diagnosis was cardiac pulmonary respiratory arrest. So her heart stopped. They found gangrene on 2/3 of the anterior wall of Linda's stomach with massing peritonitis. So huge infection. You know, that's what happens when you get a big stomach ulcer, is right, the stomach right. fluids kill everything around it, and then it gets infected. And so, you know, Linda went through straight agony for several days before her death.
Yeah, that's horrific. Like, I imagine being in that much pain and nobody fucking doing anything about it and just making it worse. Like, I can't.
And not being able to say anything.
Right.
I've just never experienced where at an organizational level, people actively stonewall an investigation. You know, the final data point I want to point out for that is in the, you know, after, like, this report continues to go on. I don't feel the need to read the rest, aside from pointing out that JRC videotapes everything.
Mm-hmm.
There is no point in anything that happened to Linda where it was not captured on tape.
Ugh.
They have videotapes in the home. They have videotapes in the day program. They have cameras that cover every inch of the facility.
Right.
So there is just not stuff that goes on at JRC that other people don't see.
Right.
There is a large number of full-time staff that do nothing all day but stare at television showing all of these monitors. So the investigator, knowing this, asked JRC to turn in the tapes.
Yeah.
And this is what it says about that. Also requested was a videotape of Linda dated either December 17th or 18th, the existence of which remains in question. BRI did not provide the tape, and neither would they confirm or deny if such a tape exists.
What the fuck?
And if you know JRC, you know that tape existed at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And this also ties into future JRC behavior. So, you know, and because JRC videotapes everything, that has become evidence in a lot of cases. So we know what happened to Andre, is it McCollins?
McCollins, yeah.
Yeah, yep. In 2002, where he was strapped to a board and tortured for hours because he refused to take off his coat. They recorded that, and we know about it because it became public in the lawsuit over it. That's the only reason we really know that happened. The only reason that saw the light of day. And there's another incident that happened in 20, like, okay, I'm unclear the specific date, but I know it's related to the Matthew Israel indictment and why he had to leave JRC and leave the state, was because in another of what was clearly one of the most horrific incidents of a disgruntled ex-employee calling JRC and telling JRC staff to shock somebody that was in bed and had done nothing wrong, something like, I'm going off the top of my head here, I believe it's something like 70 times over the course of a night. Not even with a precipitating precipitating thing that the person did that, according to JRC, would cause them to deserve to be shocked. Just an ex-employee called up and asked for this person to be shocked, and they obliged, like 70 times. Matthew Israel was indicted for destroying those tapes. So just like he refused to provide the tape here, go on like 20 years later, still doing the same thing, destroying evidence that they keep. they had the tape at one point. They refused to show it. So it shows a culture of not just setting up, you know, things that enable just absolutely horrific things like what happened to Linda. It shows a culture of being complicit in that.
So I feel like this is important to note. The director of clinical services currently is the same director of clinical services that was there in 1989 and on, Bob von Hein. So sure, Matthew Israel is not there, but your director of clinical services still exists. Mm-hmm. He didn't change his mind on how he does treatment.
Yep.
Sorry.
I mean, there's nothing in this report that gives any indication that, it seems like there's a bad judgment call about when Linda should have gone to the hospital. But using all of those aversives in the final hours of Linda's life, torturing her because she was in the act of dying, that there's no evidence that that violated JRC policy or procedure. Remember, staff specifically reached out and asked for approval to increase the number of aversives they were allowed to provide by the book. So, why is what happened to Linda important? Why is it important to remember Linda and learn from Linda's horrific experience? Well, I named one is to point out that when you make exceptions to rules about not committing acts of abuse against somebody, it doesn't just enable that specific abuse. It has wide, far-reaching, and often unconsidered effects of, like I've said, creating competing motivations, where the easiest thing to do if you're a staff member no longer is figure out what the heck is going on with Linda and take care of her. It is get her to stop. And so that's right. One. Another really important thing, and that I think carries through to 2021 today. And Sam, you already touched on this by pointing out that a lot of the same players that were there when this happened to Linda are still there. JRC hasn't shaken up the house since, you know, when Israel left. That didn't, like, sometimes they like to pretend all better now, we've turned over a new leaf. Their staffing hasn't, like, the same principles are still there. Or if they're moving on, they're moving on for other reasons other than we don't believe this anymore.
Right.
This is the culture that exists. And so if electric shock is banned at JRC, which God hope it is, that does not fix JRC. The final point I want to make in all of this is if, and understand that I am saying this if for argument's sake, I do not believe it, but if there remains a need, a theoretical need for people that it is literally life and death of where electric shock is deemed necessary for somebody in a life or death situation where they genuinely, in good faith, looking at everything they could possibly do, cannot find another way to support, even if that still exists as a need. And I don't agree that it does, but I know some people out there may think, I hope what you just read, or what I just read to you out of Linda Cornelison's report and everything else of information you can access about JRC makes the case for you that these are, if there's one place on earth that should be allowed to do this, Judge Rottenberg Center has utterly abdicated in their responsibility to be that place.
This is a horrible thing that no one should ever have to experience, let alone experience at JRC. We'd like to thank Jeff Newman for coming on and sharing his skills and this story. And it should be disturbing. We should be upset. This is something that should never, ever happen to anyone, anywhere, anytime. If you'd like to hear more information about what happens at the JRC, check out The Least of These podcast with Leah D. She has tons of information, and she interviews people who've actually been there and have worked there, lived there, and experienced the horrors of the things that happened at that place. We also recommend that you check out our Facebook page, Hops, Hooves, and Humanity, to get more information about how you can stop the shock. You can also check out our Instagram page at Hops and Hooves. Finally, be on the lookout for Jennifer Masumba's book, Shouting at Leaves, due out soon. It's an incredible book.